All right, we will call the committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd, 2013, and this is the meeting of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee. And today, members, I'll start with a couple of announcements. The Senate President requested that we distribute the Senate Code of Ethics and the Code of Conduct, we did that. I would encourage you to take a glance at it. She just wants us to all be aware, and should we follow those prudent rules and guidelines, we will probably avoid any unhappiness in our personal, and it's in your save folder, so you can just take a glance at it there. Just a quick reminder to those who haven't had the opportunity yet, RSVP to the Center for Transportation Studies gathering that we're going to have Thursday evening, the 31st. You can RSVP to Michael here. That should be in your email inbox, the invitation to do that. Also, let Michael know if you'll either be driving over and can take someone with you, or you're looking for a ride. We're going to be a center of carpooling, a hub for carpooling. The Met Council is here, so they appreciate our carpooling program. And we'll also, members, send you the transit routes and times. So, we did that already. All right. So it's still, 53 zipsy down there. The 16 is all good. So, or you can take the 3 up and around, and it'll bring you down there. Nice scenic tour of Como neighborhood. Is Sarah Wong? We have a new committee intern who also assists our page. Sarah, do you want to introduce yourself quickly?
I'm Sarah Wong. I'm a sophomore at the University of Minnesota studying science. So, yeah, I'm just here to learn all the information.
And if you can't get our committee page's attention, try to get her attention to, run notes or whatever you need. So, thank you. Members, anything for me? I guess we can start with the... Thank you, by the way. We got a lot of folks filling out their requests for special attention or input or learning opportunities, so we've compiled that, and we're going to figure out how to get that information out in front of the committee in some form or fashion. So I really, really appreciate it. And if you haven't had a chance, it's not too late, so we're still figuring out some of these. But the bills are they're not coming in very quickly, so in terms of running bills, it's going to take us a little while to get up to speed just because y'all aren't dropping in a lot of stuff. So I have no doubt it's coming, though. With that, today we are going to have an overview of transit service in Minnesota, starting with an overview from the Metropolitan Council. We'll hear from the suburban transit providers, also known as the opt-outs, the County Transportation Improvement Board, we also know as CTIB. We'll hear a little bit about Greater Minnesota Transit, and then get a report on the Council on Transportation Access, who they are and what they've been up to. And to those who are presenting, there's nothing magic about our going all the way till 5:30, and I'll mention that to members too. Plus, we have a meeting at 5, brevity is a virtue. Thanks. With that, I'll call the Metropolitan Council forward.
Thank you,
welcome.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Chair Haig.
Very much. For members that don't know me, I'm Sue Haig, and I am the chair of the Metropolitan Council, and I look forward to working with you during the course of this legislative session. I know that there is a lot of opportunity for us to partner on many things, and I'm very excited. I know we'll be presenting our budget proposal, I believe, is it next week? Is that
yes.
Right?
Yes, members. So don't get too hopped up about asking a ton of questions about the budget. Because, believe it or not, we're still kind of absorbing and synthesizing it. So we just have high levels. We're all just kind of figuring it all out. So a week from now, we'll be getting a little more detailed presentation of the budget proposal that the governor has put forth.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, as we get started here, I just wanted to apologize that I won't be able to stay for the entire hearing. I have a Metropolitan Council meeting this afternoon, so I'm going to have to leave here after a few minutes, but I know that the staff from the council will do an excellent job providing this overview. The role of the council in transportation is both a role in transportation policy planning as well as in the operation of our outstanding metro transit system, and so we're going to be talking about that. I'm going to turn that over to Judd, and then I know Brian Lamb and Amy Venowitz are also going to come up here and join us. So.
Great.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetnan. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. It's nice to see all of you again. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk to you about the Council's role here in transportation and transit. I first wanted to start off just with a very brief slide here to show the members that the Council does much more than just transportation and transit. We deal with community development through our Livable Communities Funds. We also deal with comp plans for the cities in the metropolitan area through the Land Planning Act, which is a statutory responsibility of the Council to enforce. We also run the wastewater utility in the metropolitan area, and we also work with clean water as well. But the purpose of today's meeting was really to talk about our role in transportation, so we will focus on that. The Council really has two fundamental roles in transportation, and the first role is through the planning, and that we are designated as the region's MPO, or Metropolitan Planning Organization, where we do the long-range transportation planning and deal with the shorter-term federal funds programming here in the metropolitan area. The second piece is the transit functions of the Council, where we provide, contract for, and coordinate the metropolitan transit operations, bus and rail, throughout the region. And we provide financial assistance to our local transit providers, who are our partners, the Suburban Transit Association, and also we provide the Dial-A-Ride, Metro Mobility, and those types of functions as well. We're going to get into much more detail on that here in a minute. But with that, I am going to turn that over to Amy Venowitz. She's the Deputy Director for the Metropolitan Transportation Planning and our Deputy Finance Director in that area as well, and is the former fiscal analyst for this particular committee, and does a great job for the Council. So I'll leave that up to Amy here.
Mr. Chair and members.
Welcome, Ms. Venowitz, and welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. As Judd said, I'm Amy Venowitz with Metropolitan Transportation Services, or MTS, at the Council, and I will be briefly describing the Council's transportation planning functions. As Judd mentioned, the Council serves as what is known as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, or MPO, for the region. Our activities as the MPO are primarily guided by federal law and rules, though state statute also requires us to conduct long-range transportation planning for the region. The four primary functions of an MPO are noted on this slide. The first is to perform mandated federal and state planning activities, including preparing a long-range transportation policy plan and four-year transportation improvement program, or TIP. The TIP essentially serves as a CIP for the spending of federal funds within the region and is updated annually. The Unified Planning Work Program is a one-year look at all of the transportation planning activities that will take place within the region. And then Council staff also participate on major transportation planning studies, both led by us and led by others such as MnDOT or other transit entities. The second major activity of an MPO is to allocate federal transportation funds that come to the region. In this region, we run a competitive grant process every 2 years, known as the regional solicitation. Typically, we allocate over $80 million through the regional solicitations, primarily to local entities. As the MPO, we coordinate all transportation planning activities with other transportation and governmental agencies, including MnDOT, MAC, transit operators, and others. Excuse me. Finally, one of the most important activities of the MPO is to ensure that there is public input into transportation planning and decision-making within the region. Our transportation planning activities cover all modes, highways, transit, freight, bike, and ped. The MPO also maintains a travel forecasting model. We use the model... Is that me? to predict travel flows, and in particular, use it to analyze the impacts of what will be major transportation project investments. And as I mentioned before, the Council participates in major corridor studies, both for highways and transit. Federal law requires that planning, and particularly the allocation of federal funds, be done with the participation of locally elected officials. The region's Transportation Advisory Board, or TAB, fulfills this role. The TAB contains 33 members. The membership is specified in statute, the majority of which are locally elected officials, including a representative from each of the seven counties, 10 city elected officials selected by Metro Cities, 8 citizen members selected by the council, and then also representatives of various modes and agencies participate on the TAB. The TAB's primary role is to oversee the regional solicitation and to annually adopt the TIP. The council can either concur with the recommendations of TAB on the TIP or can send it back with requested revisions, but cannot change the program of projects contained within the TIP. That concludes my remarks regarding transportation planning, and I'll turn it over to Brian Lamb.
Ms. Venowitz? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I missed the number. The regional solicitation process, how much runs through that process?
Typically, it's been $80 to $90 million every 2 years. That has recently changed under the provisions of MAP 21, and we don't have the final amounts yet, but it looks like it'll be pretty similar. The primary sources of that are Surface Transportation Program, STP funding, and CMAQ funding.
Sorry, can you say that again? CMAQ?
Surface Transportation Program, federal funding.
All right.
And then CMAQ is Congestion Mitigation Air Quality Funds.
Okay. And if I could ask a favor of staff, although it's probably easy enough for us to go do it, but we'll make you do it. Can you provide a roster of all the members of the TAB, and we'll make that available to the committee? I think that would be interesting for us to know. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lamb.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Lamb. I'm the general manager for Metro Transit. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I want to talk a little bit about the transit that is in this region and ultimately the different components of them. I'll start out. The Metropolitan Council actually has two operating arms, if you will. The largest, of course, is Metro Transit, and Metro Transit operates about 90% of the regular route bus system. Also operates the light rail and commuter rail operations. And to your point earlier, Mr. Chair, we also manage the regional rideshare services for carpooling, et cetera. And in addition, the council, the MTS, part of the council, manages the Metro Mobility Services contract regular route, which represents about 10 to 15% of the region's services, as well as the Transit Link Dial-A-Ride. We'll talk a little bit more about these services in greater detail, and oversees the contract management of the Red Line, which is the Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit line. In addition to the council provided services, there are five suburban transit providers in the suburban areas, and they provide regular route services. Let me speak a little bit about Metro Transit. Metro Transit, just this last November, we achieved yet another milestone. We served our 3 billionth customer since we became a public transit provider in 1972. And so we are very proud of that accomplishment, because the vast majority of people who use transit do so by choice. And so it's important to us where we go with ridership and the directions that we have in terms of ridership trends, because that really indicates our relevance within the larger metropolitan community. Just this last year in 2012, we served 81 million customers on Metro Transit services, which is only the second time in 30 years that we've reached that milestone. 2013, we hope to serve 82 million customers. Ultimately, Metro Transit is made up of almost 2,800 employees, and we are the 15th largest transit system based on ridership in the United States. Who rides Metro Transit, I think, is a real good question, and one of the things that we really recognize, that we provide, we link people to their livelihoods. 80%, based on our surveys, of people who ride Metro Transit do so for either work or school purposes. And in fact, there are several markets that we really are a critical component, including those who work in downtown Minneapolis. Fully 40 to 42% of the people who work in downtown Minneapolis, as well as the students who go to the University of Minnesota, get there by transit. And so that we provide a critical link there. And while 69% of the customers that we serve based on their surveys have access to cars, they choose transit because it fits their overall needs. About half of the LRT riders and one-third of the bus riders actually have household incomes above $50,000, and we think that's relevant because it reinforces that point that people who have choices in terms of their transportation mode still are opting for transit as their preferred modal choice. And then when we do survey customers, fully 9 in 10 are satisfied with the service, which compares favorably with any business. And 94% of our customers say that they would recommend the service to others. When we talk about what is kind of the foundation of our successful operation, it really goes down to building strong partnerships. And one of the strengths of our partnership building is with the businesses in which we provide service to. And we have right now almost 45,000 MetroPass customers, people who are employees of a specific business and obtain their transit passes through that business. And we work with the employers to provide a convenient pass program that includes subsidies that they can use, tax earning corporate tax benefits. In fact, just this last T21 federal agreement just reinstated an up to a $240 monthly benefit for customers who use transit that they'll be able to use on their tax benefits. But it's not only at the employer level. We have really strengthened, I think, over the course of the last 15 years, our relationships with the schools at the secondary and post-secondary level. One of our strongest programs is with the University of Minnesota. In fact, 12 years ago, about 20% of the people, students who went to the university, used transit to get to and from campus. That is now more than doubled. There's about 44% of those students now use transit on a regular basis. And we also have a healthy program with a MetroPass for staff and faculty as well. We've expanded that concept to all area local colleges, whether Metropolitan Community Technical College, Augsburg, Hamline, all those kinds of colleges, and that continues to grow. We have 49 colleges that represent about 3 million of our annual 81 million rides. In addition, you may have read about our expansion this last year with the Minneapolis Public School System for our secondary high school students, and we've now served all but two of the Minneapolis public high schools and do so successfully for the senior high, and we are replacing what was formerly delivered by a yellow school bus and actually expanding that so that people who even live outside of the or inside of the ridership boundaries are able to take advantage of the Metro Transit services. And hopefully you have even taken advantage of some of our special event services, including our hallmark State Fair service that we're proud to provide every year. And last year we provided over 467,000 rides to and from the State Fair. One of the things I'd like to highlight just for a second is some of the improvements that we've made that we think has strengthened the overall system. For instance, if you've gone to downtown Minneapolis, one of the things that you may have seen is the total reconstruction of 2nd and Marquette Avenues, which are our primary express avenues. Now we have double-width lanes that essentially allow, during the peak hours, up to 900 buses going back and up and down those two streets, which really, I think, solidifies the city's commitment to transit ridership as it continues to grow, but also that it's recognition that it has to move people, not just vehicles, inside of in and out of downtown Minneapolis. We are very committed to wearing the environmental badge very proudly. Yes,
Mr. Sorry if you mentioned it, but the Mark II lanes was a outgrowth of the Urban Partnership Agreement, which was a special program of the federal government.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
We mobilized in the region on to put forward a very comprehensive proposal, had many components, competed for those dollars, and were one of how many regions who won those?
Mr. Chair, we were one of five regions. It was a national competition that was set forth under the Bush administration in 2007, and we were one of five that successfully competed for it. And in the end, it was a $133 million grant that we received from the federal government with local match, including the state legislature, really was extremely helpful in being able to make that local match happen. Some of the things like Second and Marquette were fully funded by that, but even as you go up and down 35W South and you see the center running lanes, the 46th Street station that you see right in the middle of the median, those were funded as part of the Urban Partnership Agreement that moves all the way out to Lakeville, Minnesota, and really help fund a couple critical new park and rides that have been very successful for us.
Very great collaboration that had a lot of bipartisan support led by previous governor, Republican president, and it turned out pretty well with one gap, Lake Street. Just have to mention, all kind of breaks down at Lake Street. I hope we're going to get to that soon.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure we will, and I do want to also mention one of the things that really got a major propulsion forward with the UPA was the Cedar Avenue Bus Rapid Transit, where some critical investments were able to be made because of that program.
Thank you.
In addition to that, we have. I want to highlight just for a second that Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area has over 300 miles of bus-only shoulders, which represents not only the most bus-only shoulders in the country, but in the world. The next closest metropolitan area in the world is Dublin, Ireland. So we really have been a leader in this, which allows the buses, and regardless of what the traffic conditions, to keep moving. And really, we think that is one of the major incentives that people see when they are stuck in traffic and can see that the transit system continues to move.
Mr. Lamb, we're going to take care of buses running on the shoulder out in Senator Osmick's area. Is that true?
Mr. Chair and members, folks from MnDOT and myself have met with Senator Osmick, and we are working on that right now.
All right. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, members, we continue to build out all parts of the system, and just this last November we opened the new Ramsey Station on the North Star Line, and over the course of the first several weeks we are averaging 250 rides back and forth out of that station per day, which has been a major enhancement. We're very pleased with the initial success of that. I mentioned that I-35W BRT station that is at 46. The long-range plan is to continue to build out both at Lake Street, at American Boulevard, all the way out to Lakeville, so that the buses can maintain median services and really give high-quality service all day long. In addition, one of the things we know that the most difficult thing for a prospective customer is all of those things they have to know about taking transit. So we've really focused the last several years about trying to make the tools for customers to use transit that much easier. I already mentioned things like the go-to card, but really you can find out when your next bus is arriving, not only by schedule but by real time right there on your personal device. We have next trip at real-time information that's available. We communicate with our customers via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc., and we continue to work with our customers to make using transit that much easier. As I mentioned, we are focused on our environmental footprint, and one of the big things that we have focused on the last few years is the expansion of our hybrid buses. Hybrid buses represent about, right now, about 130 of our 900 buses on the street. We focus use of those buses in our urban local start-stop operations because they have regenerative braking power, and they get about 25% better fuel efficiency than their comparative diesel buses. And so we really are continuing to focus on that. In fact, this last couple of months, we've added the first in the country next-generation hybrid buses. We've been working with the University of Minnesota, some area manufacturers. New Flyer actually built these buses, and they're the first in the world. And the early indications are these buses are getting about 35% better fuel efficiency than our standard diesel buses.
Senator Peterson, is New Flyer in your district?
Yes, it is.
All right. Thank you for mentioning that.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Mr. Lamb, just can you put that in numbers at all, or is that something you don't have? I mean, there's a normal bus, 5 miles to the gallon, 10 miles to the gallon. What's 25% and 35% mean?
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, it is the standard bus averages about 4 miles per gallon. A hybrid diesel bus is averaging about 5.5 miles per gallon right now. So to put that in perspective, Metro Transit is the single largest diesel fuel consumer in the state of Minnesota. We use over 8 million gallons of diesel fuel a year. A couple years ago, we expanded our service by 600,000 miles or 800,000 miles in 1 year to the next, where we used hybrid buses, we used 600,000 fewer gallons of fuel. So it really has benefited us overall.
To that point, Mr. Chair, just generally, about how much more do you have to pay for a hybrid bus? Are they quite a bit more expensive, or are you finding that price to be going down? I know on cars, sometimes it's the savings is all spent in the upfront cost, but is that the case with buses right now, or just give us a
flat. Mr. Chair, Senator Westrom, great questions. And really, right now, a standard hybrid bus, is about $180,000 more expensive than a standard diesel bus. A hybrid, all the buses are bought with a mixture of 80% federal dollars and 20% local capital dollars. And what we have really focused on, because the federal government is really trying to incent transit systems to use hybrid technology, that we've been looking at the return on investment from the local dollars. And it takes about 3 to 4 years right now for the local investment, the increased dollars, to be paid back in fuel savings.
Mr. Lamb, are we using any biodiesel or soy diesel?
We are, Mr. Chair, and actually a few years ago, we successfully tested the richest mix of biodiesel, and by biodiesel on diesel side, it's a mixture of soybeans and diesel, and, of anyone in the country from a transit system perspective. During the warmer weather months, we were actually successfully operating on a 20% biodiesel mix. Unfortunately, and as you, I'm sure this committee knows, the economics of biodiesel changed quite a bit over the course of the last few years. And so now we are operating summertime and wintertime between 5 and 10% of a biodiesel mix.
There were a lot of concerns in the early days of biodiesel about cold weather, gelling, that sort of thing. What is our experience, or has that changed over time?
Mr. Chair, we did operate at some buses in the cold weather with that 20% biodiesel mix, and we found that we are starting to experience some level on a day like today of gelling, and so we've been kind of working with the manufacturers with the idea of trying to position ourselves in the future of changing some of the fuel lines and those kinds of things so that we can reduce the gelling experience that we have in our cold weather climate.
Right. Thank you. Apologize. I'm slowing you down, and I'm the one who gave the admonition to go quickly. So,
and Mr. Chair, I'll speed up as well. I just want to highlight a couple services that we do provide. The North Star Line is, of course, a 40-mile service, commuter rail service that ties in downtown with Big Lake. Our last year's ridership exceeded 700,000. One of the things that I know that the committee is aware of is that the ridership on North Star really hasn't met our initial targets. We've done some, I think, some really innovative things to spur ridership. And one of the more things, or one of the more, I think, telling results was last summer the council authorized a 7-month pilot where we were reducing the fare by a dollar. And what we found out is comparatively from the first month where we implemented in August to August ridership 2012 to 2011, ridership went up 1.1%. In October or September, it went up 4.5%. In October, it went up over 10%. In November, it went up almost 15%. In December, it went up over 20% comparatively on the weekday commuter ridership. So we believe we're really gaining some additional traction. And so we'll be going back to the council with some recommendations on what to do in the future. But bottom line is the core ridership, which is our weekday commuter ridership, continues to grow on North Star. We're very pleased with that.
Oh, Senator Osmond.
Mr. Chairman, to those numbers, actually I've looked at the numbers not just comparing to last year but going back historical years. I'd prefer if you could provide the committee more of a historical viewpoint of not just comparing to last year, because that could be an apples to oranges comparison. When you're comparing this, you need to really compare overall that there could have been peaks and valleys in the previous year. So I'd appreciate that if you can give us a more of a comparison, because I've actually been calling people and getting those numbers on a consistent basis, and your numbers are a little different than a historical perspective from what I've seen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we'd be happy to do that. And I think what the Senator, certainly one major factor, of course, in their year-to-year ridership is our special event ridership. And the first year, for example, where we provided service to the Twins games, we had really outstanding ridership, and that is really leveled off. But we will certainly provide that by day of week as well as non-special event days.
Mr. Lamb, it'd be interesting to know other external factors or just our best analysis of if you have any of that about, you know, why the ridership has changed. Or I know at one point, certainly at the peak or the trough, if you will, of the Great Recession, ridership was down because, you know, people weren't coming into town because they didn't have a job to come to town for. We reflected the same drop in vehicle miles traveled on our freeways for the same reason. The use of our parking ramps was going, you know, lots and lots of parking ramps were, public parking ramps were going unfilled and that sort of thing. So context is very important.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to provide that. And in fact, over the course of the last year and a half, we've done a lot of survey work, both with our customers as well as non-riders, to determine what are those factors that they're looking at as well. And I think that would be helpful for the committee to see that the results of that information. I do want to move on, if I could, to the Blue Line, which is formerly known as the Hiawatha Line, our light rail line connecting Mall of America to downtown Minneapolis. And I mentioned that in 2012, we actually had our highest all-time ridership on the Blue Line, over 10.5 million rides. And we do are continuing to build out that part of the system. We are in the process of receiving, as part of the vehicle acquisition order that we have with the Green Line, the University Avenue Line, additional cars to support the great ridership that we have on the Blue Line as well. And then, as a matter of fact, going to the Green Line, the Central Corridor Line, you can see probably right outside the Capitol, is that the civil construction is in large part completed. That's the construction of digging up the roadbed, putting in the stations, those kinds of things. And I'm very pleased to say we're on time and under budget at this point. Now the next focus in 2013 will be what we call the systems construction. Hooking up the catenary, getting all the systems up in operation, and we'll begin the testing of the line at the end of the year so that we'll be ready for full-scale implementation in 2014. Our 2030 ridership projection for the Central Corridor Green Line is projected to be at 41,000 rides per day, which compares to the 31,000 rides per day that we're currently experiencing on the Blue Line, which, by the way, we had expected if by the year 2025 to have about 25,000 rides per day. The next line that I want to just highlight briefly is the Green Line Extension. It's called that because the same trains eventually that start in downtown St. Paul will continue on through downtown Minneapolis and ultimately out through the western suburban area out to Eden Prairie. We just awarded, the council just awarded the preliminary engineering contracts to begin that service, our design in earnest in 2013. And we hope by the end of the year to really have some of the preliminary engineering work, most of that done, and the municipal consent activity largely done with the local community input. But it's not only on the rail side that we're really focused on improving services, and one of the things that we're really excited about is our arterial rapid bus transit program. We have a 12-corridor network that we are focusing our services on right now. We are looking for the first of those 12 corridors on Snelling Avenue, tying in Rosedale on the north end to Hiawatha on the south end, to begin operations in 2015. And we're estimating that we would, when this system gets built out, that essentially will be serving 160,000 rides per weekday by the time the system is up and operational. One of the things to note is this is a great way to really connect jobs with people, as ultimately there's 400,000 people that will be that currently live within a half a mile of any one of these lines, and more than 250,000 jobs that are within a half mile of these lines as well. So we think it's a great cost-effective way to move forward. I'll turn it back over to Amy, who will highlight some of the Metropolitan Transit services.
Excuse me, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question for Mr. Lamb. The rail Green Line in St. Paul here is done. The bus routes, do you reduce some of them, change some of them, or do some of them run the same path of even when that train is running? What's the experience with the Blue Line, because there's still buses running there, or do they what changes when that ultimately happens?
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, great question. What we do is when we implement a rail investment like this, it allows us to totally rethink how our bus service is oriented. For example, what we've took is, you may know that the Route 16 and Route 50, which are very frequent bus routes that run down University Avenue, represent a lot of a big investment. And what we were able to do is to take that investment and for the most part reallocate it so that we create better crosstown network that serves St. Paul and Minneapolis, that feed into the Green Line, if you will, and so that we're able to connect neighborhoods with the light rail line better with the reinvested bus service than we were with the service as it was originally configured. So the short answer to your question is that we do take the bus service, we rethink it, we bring it out for public comment, and we did that quite extensively, and now we're positioned in 2014 to reinvest that bus service in a way that we think will serve the metropolitan area more effectively with the addition of the Green Line.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, perhaps you've answered this already and perhaps you can help me. So I understand when you say once a line goes in, let's say for an example, Southwest, and soon thereafter you will reevaluate the bus service and how you can improve bus service so it becomes more of a feeder system into or from the LRT. My question really centers around what sort of engagement or community engagement is done on the front end of the equation while there are certain communities waiting for light rails, let's say, for an example, in North Minneapolis, and I didn't see anything around Botno in any of your diagrams here, but we have a real challenge around service and getting to, let's say, employment opportunities that are on the first tier in the first tier suburbs. So can you sort of walk me through what Met Council does in order to engage communities around their current bus service and how that can be evaluated in real time to see what improvements should be done prior to any other investments around LRT?
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, I'd be happy to. First, I want to said one thing, your mind at ease, that the Botno discussion Amy will cover in a second. And the reason why we split it up that way is that the council has yet to formally vote on accepting the locally preferred alternative, and so it's still kind of in the pre-planning stage. But to your point, one of the things I hope you start to see is the other elements. For instance, in North Minneapolis, you'll see that Penn Avenue, Emerson Fremont, and Broadway are all considered as part of the arterial BRT network in which we are trying to ultimately complement and take best advantage of the light rail infrastructure by adding bus components that will better provide that access to residents in North Minneapolis to the job opportunities throughout the region. And so we'd be happy to talk through the details, for instance, in North Minneapolis with you, because I'm really excited about the preliminary discussions that have occurred at the city level, at the county level, at the Metropolitan Council level, and at the state level, including with you, Senator, about visioning how it works all together. So we definitely include the community. We want to make sure that in the end, any of these services that we put in will meet the community acceptance test, because otherwise it's really not a sound investment.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Benowitz.
Mr. Chair and members, as Brian mentioned, the council has transit operations functions both through Metro Transit and also through Metropolitan Transportation Services, or MTS. The MTS transit operations are for services that use private contractors to provide the service for regular route, dial-a-ride, and metro mobility services. The council currently has 18 private contracts for transit service with a collective value of about $73 million in 2013, so that's an annual value. The council has been an active partner in getting the Cedar Avenue BRT transit project implemented. This project is actually led by Dakota County Regional Rail Authority. The $112 million 10-mile project consists of a dedicated bus shoulder on the right-hand side, five stations, seven new BRT-style buses, and technology real-time improvements that will be all along the corridor. MVTA, or Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, will be the service provider for Cedar Avenue, and we expect the project to open in May or June of this year, and we'll be able to come back and tell you the results next year on what we're seeing for ridership. The project you just mentioned, the Botno LRT line, is another project that the council has been actively involved with recently, and we specifically have been involved in the selection of what is known as the locally preferred alternative, or LPA, for the corridor. The alternatives analysis process in this corridor was led by Hennepin County Regional Rail Authority. The AA process analyzes a number of potential modes and alignments within a corridor and then results in the selection of a preferred alternative in mode. Hennepin County recommended LRT on an alignment that follows West Broadway Avenue and Brooklyn Park, the BNSF Railroad right-of-way through Robbinsdale and Golden Valley, and Olson Memorial Highway into downtown Minneapolis. So Hennepin County made that recommendation. The recommendation comes to the council for adoption and eventually amendment into our long-range transportation policy plan. So we're right in the middle of that process right now. The council will be hosting a public comment and hearing process around the LPA selection in the coming months. And if it agrees with the Hennepin County recommendation, we will adopt it into the long-range policy plan early this spring. Does that pretty much cover your questions regarding Botno?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair, yes, it does, around Botno, but I would love to have some offline discussion about the current bus service and just some other concerns.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did peek ahead. I'm wondering where Gateway Corridor fits in this.
Mr. Chair and members, the process I just mentioned, where typically a county regional rail authority leads the alternative analysis process. So currently Gateway is in the alternatives analysis process being led by Washington County. We actively participate in that. Council staff and then also council members typically participate on the policy advisory committee for the study. And Gateway recently narrowed down its range of alternatives that it's considering, and we're expecting that they will come forward with an LPA recommendation probably next fall. So the same process we're going through right now with Botno, we would be going through next fall to select the LPA for the Gateway Corridor.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, LPA stands for the Locally Preferred Alternative. So just so they'll adopt that, and then it'll come to the council. We use a lot of acronyms in transit and transportation.
So Ms. Benavent, sure. When you say next fall, you mean fall of 2013?
2013, we'll yes. That's the expected. I think they're down, Mr. Chair and Senator, I think they're down to narrowed down to three alternatives in LRT, BRT, and we count the no build doing nothing essentially as an alternative. So at this point, they're doing environmental work to look at those alternatives, and then a final recommendation would come in the fall.
Thank you.
All right, carry on.
Mr. Chair, as I mentioned, the council contracts with private operators. We contract about 10% of the region's regular route service, and these routes provide about 3% of the total regional ridership. Typically, contracted routes use smaller buses and often serve routes that are more lightly traveled but are necessary to maintain geographic coverage throughout the region. In areas where we do not have regular route service, the council provides general public dial-a-ride service in partnership with the counties. Dial-a-ride services are door-to-door services which use small buses and shared rides where possible. The customers pre-book the ride, but often they are asked to adjust their arrival or departure times to accommodate the availability of the service. Where possible, dial-a-ride service is coordinated with regular route or Metro Mobility services, and customers often transfer at major transfer points onto the regular route system.
Ms. Benowitz, what is a typical fare for a dial-a-ride service?
Mr. Chair, I should get back to you. I believe it's in the range of $250 to $350. It's similar to a Metro Mobility fare.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, requires the provision of transit service for persons with disabilities who are unable to use the regular route system. The Council's ADA service is known as Metro Mobility, and this provides a door-through-door service for eligible users at times and locations comparable to the regular route system. Under federal law, ADA service must be provided within 3/4 of a mile on either side of a regular route that meets certain frequency requirements throughout the day. The federally required service area is shown on this map in the green colors. The Council ADA service area is bigger than the federally required area because there is also a state law which specifies that the ADA service must be provided throughout certain communities, and those communities are shown in blue on this map. Metro Mobility is experiencing the largest growth of any of the services within our transit system. And in both 2011 and 2012, we had a 9% ridership growth over the previous year. Mr. Chair and members, I'm really going to skip over this slide. As mentioned previously, we have 12 communities which have opted out of the regular route system.
Sorry. Ms. Benowitz, is there a fare that folks pay for Metro Mobility?
Mr. Chair and members, under federal law, the ADA fare cannot be more than double the regular route fare. I believe we're actually a little bit below that right now, and the standard fare in off-peak is $2.50, and peak, I believe, is $3.50.
All right, thank you.
We'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I am going to cover the transit funding. However, I will do this very quickly. Last week, Ms. Boyd did a great job of covering most of this for the committee, and we will be back next week with our detailed presentation on the governor's budget recommendations that he outlined yesterday. Briefly, we have 5 sources of funds for our transit operating budget. It comes from motor vehicle sales tax, the state's general fund, federal funds, fares, and under local and other, it says the CTIB transitway operating funds. That comes from our CTIB partners, and that is through the current regional sales tax through those 5 counties. As you can see, in calendar year 2013, our operating budget was $463.6 million. Again, Ms. Boyd covered this last week, but again, the revenue primarily comes from MVEST, passenger fares, the state general fund, and federal funds, and the local revenue, again, is from the contributions from CTIB and Sherburne County for a piece of the North Star rail operations. Our transit capital funding sources are through state bonds, the state general obligation bonds, also through regional transit capital bonds. Those are bonds that we come to the legislature every year to seek authority for small capital-type purchases. We also receive federal funds for transit capital. Those are new starts and some other federal funds. We've got the CTIB sales tax, which helps fund, that's the 0.25 cent, again, through the 5 counties, all but Carver and Scott County. They are our partners in our transitway development, and that sales tax goes toward financing that capital. And then the regional railroad authorities participate in that as well for some of our rail investment as well. I know Commissioner McLaughlin and the folks from CTIB will cover that in much more detail here in just a moment.
Right. So, members, just to be clear, the state bonds, of course, are financed out of our general fund. Those are general obligation bonds. Regional transit capital is a levy, is a property tax levy on a subset of the 7-county metropolitan area. Federal funds are self-explanatory. CTIB is, of course, the 0.25 cent sales tax. And the regional railroad authorities, that's also a property tax levy that's done at the county level.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, we want to talk about the regional transit capital. It's the source of the capital funds for our basic transit system. As I mentioned, we'll be before the legislature this year seeking the ability to authorize the sale of bonds for our transit system. Those bonds help provide the capital dollars that we need to match those federal funds that we just mentioned a moment ago. And these bonds also support all of the transit providers in the region. It's just not Metro Transit. It's Metro Mobility. It's our suburban transit providers. It is the Dollar Rides Vanpool. It is for all metropolitan area transit providers. And the levy is paid by the capital levy, those communities that you see on the screen. And I'm sure we'll have much more conversation. I think one of the issues, Mr. Chair and members, is whether or not these bonds, we will be before you discussing them. And in the past, they've been carried in the tax bill under the public finance article. But then just the last couple years, they've been carried in the transportation finance bill as well. So we'd like to have that conversation with you about how we would like to proceed with them if you choose to give us that authority. So thank you with that. And again, Mr. Lamb is going to wrap up here regarding our regional transit usage.
Mr. Chair, members, just quickly, two slides I want to show over time. This is what the ridership of the system looks like. And starting from 2004, which is actually a lower column in terms of total ridership, quite frankly, because that was a year that Metro Transit had a 44-day strike. And so that was the impact that you saw and then the post-strike recovery of ridership. But since that time, in 7 of the 8 years, Metro Transit and regional ridership has increased every one of those years, and you can see it bimodal type. The other thing I wanted to just highlight was the regional growth in park and ride spaces. Right now there's almost 30,000 park and rides spaces available in the region. The last decade we've seen not only growth in the number but really a growth in the size of the individual park and ride. 10-15 years ago, a park and ride was most typically a shared use with a church or something on that line, maybe 50-75 cars. What we've found is by building larger park and rides, what we can augment that is with good frequency. And really going back to one of the lessons learned on North Star, when you have 6 trains a day, it is hard for people who are used to ultimate choice to opt in, if you will, to a transit system that gives them limited choices. By the building of larger park and rides, what we have found is that those tend to be the most popular by their nature because we can actually offer very frequent service, and then it really kind of has a chicken and the egg kind of a impact on us. And one of the things that I think is continually a fact that reinforces to us is that park and rides assist not only regional residents within the 7-county area, but fully 14.5% of all park and ride users are people who reside outside of the 7-county area. And as you can imagine, that varies by park and ride along certain major corridors. And then with that, Mr. Chair, I think that. Oh, one more. This.
Yeah. Trying to.
Mr. Chair, I'll go through this quickly. The other major thing that we participate in is transitway development. Our current transportation policy plan calls for doubling transit ridership by 2030. And we would do this both by growing our base bus system, but also by building a system of regional transitways throughout the region. The transitway vision is articulated in our long-range transportation policy plan. It calls for a variety of transitway modes, including LRT, dedicated busway, commuter rail, arterial BRT, as Brian spoke about earlier, highway BRT, and express bus corridors, and a whole system to be created throughout the region. This map shows the currently adopted 2030 transitway vision. It includes 7 corridors in the solid red that are complete in construction or engineering, and I believe we've spoken about most of those corridors. It has 8 candy-stripe corridors. These are the corridors that are still in the alternatives analysis process, have not yet selected a preferred mode or alignment, but the plan identifies them as corridors that should undergo development. Then Brian also talked about our arterial BRT corridors. These are the corridors shown in blue on the map. Urban corridors, which are currently our heaviest traveled bus routes. And then finally, we also have highway BRT corridors, or corridors shown in yellow, which are our best commuter express bus corridors. Developing a transitway can be a very long process. Typically, system planning is done through the TPP, which identifies the most promising corridors. Those corridors then undergo an alternatives analysis, again, typically led by the county regional rail authorities. That process ends in the selection of an LPA, locally preferred alternative, with both the mode and alignment selected. The corridor then moves into preliminary engineering, which can take 1 to 2 years. Final design can take 1 year. Construction typically takes 3 to 4 years, depending on the length and complexity of the corridor. So you end up with a total development process of anywhere from 8 to 10 years from the start of planning to implementation of a major transitway. And then that concludes our presentation.
All right. Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you. And
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
I was just wondering, we talked about ridership. Do you have any statistics on operating expenses and how those are being funded?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do, and we can provide that not only within our system, but we also are participants in the National Transit Database. So I know you didn't specifically ask that, but we can show our costs and cost-effectiveness indicators against our peers throughout the country.
And, Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, there's also some information that was done. It's a couple years old now, but it was done by the legislative auditor who did a study of regional transit, and they looked at all providers of transit and types of service that will be able to provide you the cost versus the ridership as well for those rides.
Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, one other question. When you add in rail, how much do you of your ridership, how much do you expect to be new riders versus how much do you expect to be riders that transfer from other modes of transit?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it varies by which rail line we're talking about. But just for Hiawatha as an example, the blue line, what we found was about 40% of the initial ridership in Hiawatha were brand new to the system, and others had been previously maybe occasional users. See, it's a question of not only the person but the frequency, and so we do have those kind of breakdowns, and we can provide that to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, members, thank you very much, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and we have to run back to the council, so when we leave, not because we don't want to be here.
You're just trying to dodge other hard questions, aren't you?
No.
When they occur to us. All right. Next up, we have the suburban transit providers, the opt-out communities. Welcome to the committee. Clark, did you bring Clark bars?
Mr. Chair, no, I did not. Next time.
Members, and when Mr. Clark was Representative Clark, we served on transportation together in the House. And when he presented a bill, he would always bring us Clark bars.
Mr. Chair, thank you for remembering.
And he was making less than he is now, and he's not bringing them. That's bad.
Yeah, you make a lot more. Bring us 2 Clark bars.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Clark.
Thank you. James Clark with Messerly & Kramer, representing the Suburban Transit Association. And Mr. Chair and members, with me today are the Suburban Transit Association Chair, Eagan City Council Member Gary Hansen, and the Suburban Transit Association Vice Chair, Plymouth City Council Member Jeff Waji. And with that, Mr. Chair, if Council Member Hansen could continue with our presentation.
All right. Welcome, Council Member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate this opportunity to provide just a brief overview of the suburban transit providers. As Mr. Clark indicated, I am Gary Hansen. I am a member of Vegan City Council and chair of the Suburban Transit Association, as well as the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. As you can see from the logos on the screen, we are represented by six suburban transit providers providing service to 12 communities in the region. As indicated by those logos, they include Shakopee, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Prior Lake, as well as Southwest Transit serving the areas of Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska, and the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority serving Apple Valley, Burnsville, Egan, Rosemount, and Savage. So those are the 12 communities that chose not to be part of the traditional transit system as authorized by legislation that was enacted 30 years ago. And they came together in 1995 to form the Suburban Transit Association for the purpose of jointly and cooperatively developing programs of mutual interest that would benefit the citizens of the community served. And I think just as importantly, the entire region, by contributing to an integrated transit system throughout the region. And they add, doing so, we very much value a good working relationship with the Metropolitan Council.
Mr. Hansen, is it fair to say this was back in the days when much of the transit system was funded both operating and capital off the property tax, and these communities were paying that property tax and not receiving much in the way of service?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Yes. The suburban transit providers do provide flexible transit services through a variety of programs, and those include flex routes and reverse commute services, local service between communities, regional transit centers, dial-a-ride, and neighborhood services. So quite a variety of services. But, of course, our primary product is the peak period bus service connecting the suburbs to Minneapolis and St. Paul and back. Our providers are growing, as are the areas that we serve. Our vice chair, our SDA vice chair, Mr. Waji, will comment on that very soon. We do produce strong results. We believe that we can be trusted to deliver on time and on budget. We're very proud of the fact that we have very high customer satisfaction ratings in the range of 97% to 99%. So I think that reflects very highly on the service that we provide, also on the dependability and the reliability of our service. In 2012, our vehicles were driven nearly 9 million miles, and we did that with no deficiencies in Department of Transportation inspections and no vehicles which were removed from service. And the result of that is dependable and reliable service and continued high customer service rating. With that, Mr. Chair, I would, if I may, I would like to turn it over to the STA Vice Chair, Jeff Waji.
Thank you, Councilmember Hansen.
Welcome to the committee. You could just introduce yourself for the tape.
Yes, I'm Jeff Waji. I am on the Plymouth City Council and Vice Chair of Suburban Transit Association. I just have a few slides to go through. As Councilmember Hansen had indicated, one of the real focuses of the suburban transit providers is because we support individual communities is to really focus on strong customer support and service for that. And in doing so, each community takes a different approach as how they service their client base, their riders. I think if you look at like Southwest or Maple Grove, where they have very strong park and ride facilities that in a strategy they've really gone to service their markets. You can contrast that with Plymouth, which has very much of a neighborhood route. We have Plymouth is one of a couple of communities that still provide a dial ride service within the community. And so it's much more focused on the residents and the community and the needs of that community. And so it also allows us to do innovative approaches in terms of that I'll touch base on in a couple places here in the bullets. But again, I think the focus on the suburban transit is you really focus on the individual needs of each community that we serve. We have focus service from transit hubs, park and rides, where we integrate development of retail housing, transit-oriented development, a lot of what you see with light rail on, and integrating a lot of the development. The suburban providers have also integrated as they've developed park and rides. So you can look at Egan, which has developed a park and ride in conjunction with the retail development. So as people get off buses, park and ride, there's the dry cleaner and the coffee shop, whatnot, that are there. We have Eden Prairie, which has really taken, as I mentioned, a strong focus on park and rides, where they have 900 stalls. And it's a component of those, along with housing and restaurants within that. You have Maple Grove, which partners with Arbor Lakes, which contributes to the cost of that park and ride. So it's really looking at a retail partnership to help with those costs. And even in Plymouth, we're looking potentially at developing a park and ride where we can partner with retail, similar to what some of these other communities have done as well. I'd also point out that the suburban transit providers were the first to bring the coach-style buses for long-distance commutes into the region, and now all the transit providers, including Metro Transit, are using the coach-style buses, especially for those longer transits. We also are working with our MVTA, Minnesota Valley Transit, is working with the University of Minnesota in developing a driver assist technology. So this is some of the innovative approaches they're looking at. If there's inclement weather or if we get some snow and it's hard for that bus, especially if it's going on the shoulder, to know exactly where it should be, there's what we're using as driver assist technology, where literally you could drive that bus could drive itself down the road and know exactly where it should be using satellite, within inches of where it belongs. So the driver really doesn't have to guess anymore on where it needs to be with that level of technology. And then there's a training facility in Burnsville that drivers go to get trained on that. One of the important things I think we wanted to point out was just looking at the population growth and the employment growth we've experienced over the last 20 years, and then what's being projected in these communities over the next 20 years. So if you look at that slide, we've had from 1990 to 2010 a 61% growth of population in those communities. We've had like growth in employment. We've had a 64% growth over that same time period. And then as we look out into from 2010 to 2030, where we're looking at roughly 168,000 growth, we're also looking at 140,000 growth in jobs. So almost as many jobs growing as we are projecting population growth in these communities. So that's important. I think one thing, like I know Plymouth, we have reverse commutes. And so as we have our buses go downtown, we also pick up riders and bring those out to businesses. Plymouth is blessed to have a fair amount of commercial industrial base, especially along 494 and 169, and we have people that take the bus that take a transfer downtown, and then they come back out to their employment in Plymouth. So that's one of the ways we get riders back and forth, just to try and meet that employment goal.
Mr. Roche? Is Plymouth the only provider who does the reverse, or do others provide that as well?
Mr. Chair, all the providers seek to have reverse commute, and they do provide some reverse commute service. It's something that they would like to see continue to grow,
right.
And that I think would like, as I mentioned, would like more reverse commute providers in the future.
Thank you. That would be great, and stand ready to. Especially when I look at this employment growth, I'm guessing you're going to want to have access to all kinds of workers from all kinds of areas. Thanks.
Absolutely. And I know in Plymouth we really focus on our routes that go to our commercial industrial base. So if we have routes that are coming out to us, they're going back just to residential Those don't fit a need for the that as much as the ones that are going to those commercial properties do. Looking at our ridership from 1990 to the present, if you look at the first, the blue is from 1990, then the red would be 2010, and of course 2012 only shows a two-year change in ridership, but I think it's important that we look that all these riderships are showing significant increases in ridership. And I think the other thing that's, I think, important to note, as people and the population expands in these communities, and they, someone new moves into Northwest Plymouth, once they start their behavior pattern of how they get to work, if they're coming to work downtown, you know, it's really hard to change that. I think the question was made when the Met Council was here. You know, we've done looked at some studies and some variables, whether it's the parking garages, the unemployment rate, the price of gas. What's really the driver as to what drives our ridership? Our best that we've done pulling those data together is looking at gas prices. If you get to $4 a gallon, our ridership goes up. And if it comes down to $3 a gallon, our ridership goes down. And the other things like the cost of parking garages downtown or unemployment certainly has impact to it, but not nearly to the degree that gas price does. And so I think the point I'm making is that if people get into a pattern of how they use transit or don't use transit, it really takes something like a cost of gas going up or something to really cause them to change their driving patterns or how they get to work. And so as we look at some of the projects we've identified for 2013 and beyond, I think it's important as to get those in place so as the population does keep expanding, we have the ability to offer those transit options for our communities. With that, I'll turn it back over to James.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, we've identified four issues that we would like to present to the legislature this year. Back in 2011, as part of the budget negotiations, there was a freeze placed on the suburban providers, an MVEST freeze. MVEST is one of two sources of funding for the suburban providers. One is the fare box, and then the other is MVEST funds. And so that freeze is scheduled to be lifted in June of this year, and so that we would hope that in fact would take place. We do support additional transit operating funding for the entire region, and we would like to see a portion of that for the suburban providers, given the growth that we just outlined and the employment activity in these communities. We'd like to see a portion of that funding come to the suburban transit providers. We'd also would like to talk to the committee about funding demonstration projects. Minnesota Valley Transit, Southwest Transit, and Shakopee Transit have all talked about possibly serving regions beyond their communities and feeding the existing park and rides, and so we'd like to have a discussion with the committee on whether there's some funding available for those projects. Also, it was noted earlier by Mr. Shetton and Mr. Land, the regional transit bonds. And currently, I think the amount that the Met Council will seek authority for is approximately $34 million. These bonds are very critical to the suburban providers. They provide for the bus replacements, also for many of the capital projects, the smaller capital projects. And we would very much be supportive of a larger authorization, larger than the $34 million that we think the Council will come forward with. And we'll be supportive of any number that they do provide and work with them, but would hope that maybe there's an ability to go above the $34 million mark. And with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Great. Thank you. Very informative. Questions, members? All right. You're so thorough. It's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And we look forward to working with you on all these items.
We will return with Clark Mars.
Senator, very much. Next, we're going to hear from the County Transportation or County Transit Improvement Board, CTIP. Welcome, Commissioner McLaughlin.
Chairman. Not sure how I changed the slideshow here. Get it to work.
Have any AV assistance? Not me.
Won't press any buttons. Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Peter McLaughlin.
We'll get the young people to help you out.
Pardon me?
We'll get the young people to help you out.
Just don't want to break it, you know.
And Mr. McLaughlin, I think you were here at the top when I mentioned that there's nothing magic about us going all the way till 5:30. So, and in fact, some of us have a meeting at 5. So
I take your point, Mr.
All right.
Chairman.
I want to tamp you down. Just making a.
All right, I'll start introducing myself while this is coming up.
Wohlschlager might help us.
Here we go. Great. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Peter McLaughlin. I am chair of the county's Transit Improvement Board, which is comprised of the five counties that opted in to the sales tax for transit expansion in the metropolitan area in the year 2008. I am joined today by Lisa Weick, Washington County Commissioner, one of the members of the county's Transit Improvement Board. So I'm going to just give you a short history of what we've done at the County's Transit Improvement Board and start with a thank you to the members of the legislature who were here, who actually entrusted, had enough faith in the counties that we would make good decisions and we would help to expand the transit system through the transportation bill in 2008. So I want to thank the legislature for that faith, and I think we've really done a good job of living up to that faith, Mr. Chairman and members. What we did is we were given the authority to impose a 0.25% sales tax in seven counties in the metropolitan area. Five of the counties opted to do that. Scott and Carver did not opt to do that. Those five counties represent 90% of the population of the metropolitan area and over 95% of the sales tax generated in the metropolitan. The sales tax has generated approximately $100 million in the past year, $101 million. We've recovered along with the state's economy with the recession. So $100 million is what the 0.25% throws off. So I wanted to go walk through, Mr. Chairman, if I could, the expectations of the legislature when this law was passed in 2008 over the governor's veto. One was that the money was supposed to be for expansion of the transit system in the metropolitan area. There's specific language in the law that says the money must supplement, not supplant, existing investment in transit. There was a clear understanding that it was for construction, not studies. People thought there were enough studies on the shelves that we ought to be going forward with building. We did that. We made an exception for Washington County, which frankly didn't have projects that were ripe, and we made an exception and we have allowed them to fund studies, and I think that's been proven to be a good decision as they've moved forward on the Gateway Corridor, among other things. We were told to keep the administrative expenses to a minimum. The limit was 0.75% of the tax that's collected for our administrative expenses. There was an expectation of property tax relief, and that property tax relief has totaled almost $70 million since the tax was put in place in 2008, and that covers operating costs that had heretofore been paid out of property taxes from the regional railroad authorities. That was assumed by the sales tax. And there would be a reduction in the amount of capital investment that the county rail authorities would be required to make as well, and that's been put in place. We were directed in the law to maximize federal funds, and it was a clear effort to try to reduce the reliance on state bonding for these big projects. And as you'll see later, that dropped from 33% state share down to a 10% state share of the capital costs of these major projects. So here's what we've done. We've invested in engineering, construction, and operations. We've invested in BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, commuter rail, and light rail. We have not funded studies, with the exception that I mentioned for Washington County. We don't invest and have not invested in intercity passenger rail. For example, the high speed to Chicago, that is not within our province. We have not invested in regular route bus service. That's the province of the Metropolitan Council, nor in arterial BRT, which you heard discussed. We tried to concentrate on these major corridors and making investments to get those online quickly. We have invested almost $500 million since 2008. You can see the projects depicted here on this map. Some of its capital costs, some of its operating costs, some of its stations, some of its lines. It's fair to say that there would be no central corridor, now 87% completed, without the sales tax being in place to make that 30% investment in that line, and frankly providing the cash flow for that project as well. So this is the list of grants, just for your records. That's what the $500 million consists of: capital, operating, and then the special grants for Washington County. The county's Transit Improvement Board is a major investor in these projects. This is for new starts projects like Central, like Southwest. 50% federal has been the practice. 10% comes from the county rail authorities, 10% from the state through bonding funneled through the Metropolitan Council, and then 30% out of CTIB. And on the operating side, the CTIB funds have provided for 50% of the net operating cost increase associated with these major lines. The other half comes from the state and Metropolitan Council. So we've invested heavily. If you redo these numbers, on the non-federal side of this, counties through either CTIB or the rail authorities are providing 80% of the non-federal share of these projects. 80%. We're also assuming a significant financial risk because we're funding the preliminary studies and the like that don't elicit federal funds, that don't elicit state funds. And so we've been out in front providing leadership to make sure that these projects happen on a timely basis. But this is a little chart that I like to show because it shows the shift in the money. The before the county's Transit Improvement Board, this is the split in the money for the North Star Corridor, 50% federal, 33% state, and 17% county rail authority. Now it switched over to, again, 50% federal. The state is reduced to 10%. The county rail authorities are reduced to 10%, and the county's Transit Improvement Board through the sales tax provides 30% of the money. So the state share of Central Corridor was $91.5 million of the capital. It would have been $315 million if the old system where the state was providing 33% of the capital costs of these lines had been in place. And so state reduction here in state bonding was $224 million just on Central Corridor, and we were anticipating continuing this division where the state was contributing 10%. That's been our working assumption. We'll have a discussion of that in the weeks to come in relation to the governor's proposal. These are the projects that we funded. We brought $1.5 billion in federal funds into the state of Minnesota since the Hiawatha days. This predates CTIP. But $1.5 billion in federal funding for transit that would otherwise have gone to Denver or Phoenix or Portland or Seattle or all these other regions around the country that are investing in transit expansion with which we compete. But because we've had in place these systems to bring this money in, just as the legislation directed us, bring federal money in, we brought in $1.5 billion. And I will tell you that Peter Rogoff, the head of the FTA, when we put the sales tax in place, he said that our local financing system went up the ladder among regions around the country because we had a reliable source of funding available to match the federal funds. So the net result of this is that we've really got the first generation of projects essentially done. We're with Hiawatha, North Star, Cedar, and Central. They're essentially done. The whole CTIB share for Central Corridor has already been contributed. The second generation of projects is in the wings, and we're ready to move forward on those. So this is how the organization of CTIB works. We have local elected officials from five counties, the five counties that opted in. Again, we represent 90% of the metro population and over 95% of the sales tax in the metro area. And the task of creating this joint powers board is a little bit like what the 13 colonies had to do. This is the population distribution. You get big and little, and how do you figure out, how do you protect the little guys? How do you make sure that the big guys don't feel like the three small states or could gang up on them? And so we managed to work that out, Mr. Chairman.
Bicameral
legislature? We didn't, without a bicameral legislature. That was the trick here. And so how we did it was the following. The law provided that there could be weighted voting. And we took advantage of that. And we said half of the weighting should be on sales tax revenue generated and half on population. On the sales tax, you can see it's actually 55% from Hennepin County. It's about 5.5%, at least when we negotiated it, from Washington County. So it's a tenfold difference in revenue between the largest and the smallest county. Population varies pretty dramatically as well. And so what we did, and we did this in 5.5 weeks from a blank piece of paper. We negotiated a joint powers agreement. The votes on the county board to join this joint powers board and to impose 0.25% sales tax. So by April 1st, we actually put that in place. So we have 100 votes total. That's how we did it among the five counties plus the Metropolitan Council. The vote distribution was such that we had 47 for Hennepin County, 5 for the Met Council, and the different numbers for the other counties in between. To pass anything, to pass approval of the agenda, it takes 63 votes and the votes from at least 3 counties. So that's how you protect everybody, try to get more of a consensus to make sure that we have things. And you have to have, if you're going to make a big investment, like if you're going to issue bonds or you're going to invest, make a commitment to a central corridor for almost $270 million, you have to have 75 votes, and again, the votes of at least 3 of the counties to make that kind of a commitment. That system has worked very well. We've had unanimous votes on all of our capital investments so far, and so it has promoted regional unity. And in that regard, all the grants have to be consistent, and this is in statute. They have to be consistent with the Met Council's transportation plan. So this is how it fits together. And so we're not going off on our own. We are a source of capital to help the Met Council in realizing their transportation policy plan. And we have we've adopted guiding investment principles that have to do with geographic equity to make sure that all of the region benefits, that there's regional mobility that we're enhancing, and connectivity of people to jobs and other locations over time.
Commissioner, can you talk for just half a second about the GEARS committee, city officials who advise?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I did omit that. The GEARS committee was in the statute. It includes county representatives, Met Council representatives, and also representatives of cities across the region, and they review all the grant applications and make a recommendation to the county's transit improvement board, which has the decision-making authority. But it brings the cities into the process, into our annual process of making grants, and they're looking at long-term strategy as well.
Thank you.
On the back to the lean organization, here's the pie chart. We spent 99% of our money, 99.25% of our money on grants and 0.75% for administrative expenses. We don't own any buildings. We don't own any property. We don't. We make use of county legal and financial and communication staff. We don't have any employees. We use outside firm to help us with that. We do hire bond counsel and financial advisors to make sure that we have professional help on that, and we coordinate on a literally daily basis with the Metropolitan Council. So that's how we get to this number that was directed by the statute, and we're very comfortable with that. We think we've been good stewards of the resources that have been made available by our vote to impose the sales tax. We've used a pay-as-you-go approach wherever possible, but when we got to the central corridor where we had to cash flow, we were going to need to contribute over $100 million a year, which is more money than we were bringing in. We got to that point. We had to do that 3 years running, and at that point we borrowed money, $110 million in bonds that we issued. and we did an examination of that, and we had Hennepin County issue the bonds because we were a known, Hennepin County was a known entity in the bond market. Springstead, our financial advisor, said that probably saved us almost $3 million by having a known entity go into the bond market backed up by the sales tax revenue as opposed to a new joint powers agreement that nobody on Wall Street would know or care about trying to do it. So we think we've been good stewards, and we've received unqualified financial audits from the state auditor each and every year. Mr. Chairman, just a quick description of why we do this. If you look at the U.S. cities and states and you rank them, the Twin Cities economy would be the 37th largest in the country. If you did regions around the country, we'd be the 13th largest region according to gross metro product. So we are a large player in the nation's economy. We have seen, I've given you the glasses half full speech about all the ways in which we've invested over the last few years, but this is a two-scale depiction of what other regions around the country have done in terms of investment in transit lines. And you can see that, you know, leave out New York and Boston, those have been around for 100 years. But these other regions that with which we compete, you can see that we have a very modest investment in these modern transit. Here's another depiction of that of Salt Lake, Denver, Dallas compared to cities, and you can see that we are lagging behind. And I will tell you, they're not stopping in Salt Lake, they're not stopping in Denver, and they're not stopping in Dallas. And so we're behind and we're forward. So we think we need to invest in transit because we have to compete with these other regions, not only in the United States but around the world. I have people come to me and say, well, you know, you're from Minneapolis. Your biggest competitor is St. Paul. And I say, yeah, it's St. Paul, Sao Paulo, Brazil, not St. Paul, Minnesota, because that's really the nature of the modern economy. That's where we're competing. We're going to grow 900,000 more people in the next 30 years, and the demographics are changing with the millennials and the Gen Xers who are want to use the mass transit, and the seniors who also need to use it as well. And I ride on the Hiawatha a lot, and I have to say, I look for those Target badges as I'm riding. There are dozens and dozens of them on each and every train in the morning going down to downtown Minneapolis to work at the Target headquarters. Just an example of who's riding. We're moving high volumes of customers in the high-volume corridors, okay? We're not building light rail everywhere. We're not building BRT everywhere. We're concentrating it in these high-density corridors. 13% of all the Metro Transit riders are on Hiawatha. We've got about average weekday ridership of 31,000 people. That's 30% more people than were projected to ride Hiawatha in the 2020 ridership for the year 2020 when the thing was being planned. Central will have 41,000 riders a day. Southwest is at 30. Botno is at about 27 or 28. Once you add Central, you'll have a quarter of all the rides on the Metro Transit system will be two rail lines. Met Council's gone over some of this about how efficient their system is. Compared to our peer regions, we have a very low subsidy rate and high fare box recovery. So I want to just do a brief discussion of development along the Hiawatha. We said that we thought these investments would induce development. Well, there have been 414 different development projects, housing, mixed-use, commercial, along Hiawatha and Central since 2000, many of them commercial, 179 of the 414. And a lot of private development, and some have public subsidy. But this has been a magnet in the for development, and it continues to be a magnet along each and every stop. And they're doing it prospectively along Central, and it's starting to happen along Southwest as well. In 1999, there was a study done that projected that there would be 7,600 new housing units. 7,120 new housing units along the Hiawatha corridor by the year 2020. By the year 2010, there were 7,600 new housing units already, and I will tell you that since 2010, there have been additional units as well. Thank you very much. So it has been attracting more development than it had been predicted. Along Central Corridor, $1.2 billion in new development there, 55 different projects. It's market rate and affordable housing, commercial and retail as well. So we're seeing development as predicted. It's just a quick slide I like to show. These are the businesses that got contracts on Central Corridor. Check out where they're from across the state of Minnesota. There's a similar chart that shows where the employees along Central Corridor have come from. I don't have that with me today, but it also has a great geographic spread. So, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, we think that there's a great shared vision for transit as a part of the growth of this region. It is a shared vision among counties and cities, the Met Council, the public, the business community, and we've got a great we are in great standing with the Federal Transit Administration because of the way that we've handled this. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, members? Senator Kipmeyer.
Thank you. I so appreciate your presentation of all this information. I thought the one thing I was struck by coming from an area that travels a bit to Hennepin County, when you pay property taxes, the county gets credit for it because it is your property tax base that does it. Sales tax, however, a lot of credit for that comes from outside your five-county area, Mega Mall, people flying in, games, a whole bunch of activity like that. So the rest of rural Minnesota contributes also to this. So I just thought I'd make that comment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, that's
Senator Carlson has made that comment. Point before. Commissioner.
That's a fair comment. We understand. We've, as someone who actually, I've been supportive of these investments, and we know that they help to bring people in, attract businesses, and the businesses make investments. And so it's I think we work together. And, my taxpayers always like to say that they like to spend money up in Crow Wing County and beyond, too, as we go out to greater Minnesota as well. So thank you.
Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, on the slide that you mentioned, the new housing units in and around the area of the Hiawatha LRT. Do you have a feel for what the increment is in real estate taxes that may have been generated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, I don't have those that aggregated. I do know the University of Minnesota did a study of housing in South Minneapolis. It was the housing that was close to the line, and then there was the housing that was a little further removed from the line. Relatively similar housing, and the housing that was closer to the line actually held its value by 4% during the dip in values in housing in the last few years. And so we think that's attributable to the line being there. But there's major investment that's gone on here, and we can try to aggregate what the total value of those properties would be. I mean, the history of – I don't know if everybody knows the history of Hiawatha Avenue. In 1960 – there was going to be a six-lane freeway with four lanes of frontage road built along Hiawatha Avenue. Hundreds of houses, hundreds of businesses were taken. Just a giant swath was cut through South Minneapolis, and then there was essentially an impasse with the community until 1985, when the agreement was made to do the Hiawatha Road that's out there today, which is limited access, limited turning and the like, and that was going to be complemented by a light rail. What's happened since then, there are over, last time I looked, and I'll look again, but there were well over 300 housing units that were built and occupied already on land that was taken by MnDOT in 1960 because we skinnied up the right-of-way that was necessary so that land could go back onto the tax rolls and could become a place for housing already. So that's one of the benefits that occurred here. The investment that was made in Hiawatha Avenue when it was skinnied up and made smaller, MnDOT saved over $100 million on construction. If it had constructed the big model, it was at least $100 million. We did this estimate quite some time ago. And the state's investment in Hiawatha was about $100 million. And so, in fact, the state came out pretty well in that transaction.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thanks, members. Minda, Greater Minnesota Transit. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Frankel.
Members, while Mr. Schadauer is booting up his presentation, I'll just introduce the topics. My name is Tim Hinkle. I'm an assistant commissioner with MnDOT. My responsibilities are for the direction of the modal planning and program management division within the department. One of the seven offices under that umbrella is the Office of Transit, responsible for Greater Minnesota Transit. Our presentation today will give you an overview of Greater Minnesota Transit, as well as an overview of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access, as established by legislation a few years ago. To kick this off, Mr. Schadauer will give you the Greater Minnesota overview.
Welcome, Mr. Schadauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Mike Schadauer. I'm the director of the Office of Transit for MnDOT, and I'm going to give you a quick overview of Greater Minnesota Transit. Unlike Met Council, we don't operate any transit in MnDOT. We provide grants and technical advice to a bunch of different transit providers across the state. So as of 2012, there were 58 different transit providers divided into 6 large urban, 12 small urban, and 39 rural providers, plus the North Star Commuter Rail. We grant money to Sherburne County for the state's share of the subsidy for the portion of North Star that runs outside the 7-county metro area. A lot of these numbers for small urban and rural transit providers are starting to shrink because we've been encouraging the transit providers to look at how they can work together, and that can take different forms of cooperation, coordination, or consolidation. And so by the time you see these figures for next year, there'll be 3 fewer small urbans, 5 fewer rurals, and one of the small urbans will have moved up to the large urban class. Mankato reached 50,000 population and moved up. Minnesota statutes instruct MnDOT to provide transit service to all the parts of Minnesota, and frankly, we're not quite there yet. Right now, we provide countywide service in 70 counties of the 80 counties in greater Minnesota. That leaves 2 counties right now that have no public transit service at all, and 8 counties that have service only in a municipal area out of the county. I hope that we can do better on this in the future, but it takes not only funding but willing local partners. So we continue to work with local areas that don't have transit, as well as the transit providers in surrounding areas, to see when there's opportunities to expand this even further.
Oh, excuse me. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just those 2 counties are what, and what are the 2, what are the 8 counties? If you
sure.
Could
the 2 counties that have no transit at all are Waseca and Wilkin, and then the 8 counties that have only municipal service are Blue Earth, Cass, Clearwater, Faribault, Freeborn, Le Sueur, Nicollet, and Olmsted.
Thank you.
Greater Minnesota Transit ridership has generally been increasing over the last several years and hit a record ridership of 11.5 million riders in the last year. We have full data, 2011. People that ride transit in Greater Minnesota are quite varied, especially in the urban areas. There's a lot of people that use it for work. They are choice riders. So 33% of all the riders in Greater Minnesota are going to work. 20% are going to school. 50% of the people use transit 5 days a week. Of the people that use transit in the rural communities, 50% of those are 65 years and older. So you see there's a little bit different demographic in the rural communities. And 76% of those seniors are female. A lot of those senior trips, about a third, are going for basic life needs, medical trips and shopping. To kind of connect people to their lives that way. A lot of the investments that are made in Greater Minnesota Transit are based on an investment plan that was done back in 2011, and that provided us strategies for different scenarios, whether we have funding to expand, whether we have funding only to preserve the system, or we have reduced funding and we have to contract. We've been fortunate since then to be in mostly a preservation and a little bit of an expansion mode across different parts of the state. One of the other aspects of that investment plan were some goals that were set by the statute requesting the plan by the legislature. It instructed MnDOT to identify how we are doing against 2 goals. One is meeting 80% of the transit need by 2015, and the other was to meet 90% of the need by 2025. So as of the last year, we have full data, 2011, We're at about 63% of the need met to date. Some of the things that are going to be happening in the future are revolving around the new federal transportation law, Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century, or MAP 21. Some of the things that are happening from that include some consolidations where some of the old programs that used to be separated are now combined. So a job access reverse commute program has now been combined with the urban formula transit program and with the rural formula transit programs. Similarly, the new Freedom program, which is designed to give people with disabilities even greater access, has now been combined with the elderly and disabled program. That really hasn't changed much in the way of funding, because the funding that was available from the separate programs in the past basically equals the funding that's available from the consolidated programs for the future. However, on the capital side, MAP 21 is going to have a harsher impact to Greater Minnesota Transit. It's going to cause a reduction in the funding that's available for vehicles. And this is primarily caused by not so much what's happening in the Federal Transit Administration funding, but by what's happening in the flexible funding through the Surface Transportation Program. For the years that aren't programmed yet, so it's basically starting in 2017, there's going to be a lot less money available for local communities, area transportation partnerships to program. And a big factor for them in the past has been to put some money towards their local transit programs for buses. They're going to have about half as much money available starting in about 2017 to do that. So let's talk a little bit more about the funding. This chart is intended to show where we've been for the last couple years and where we think we're going. It assumes that the federal funding stays basically flat with MAP 21 and whatever follows MAP 21. It also is assuming that the general fund is staying at the base levels that are currently identified in statute. It's assuming the MMB's forecast for motor vehicle sales tax, both leased and regular, and then that only goes through about 2015, and that it's assumed to rise about 2.5% per year for inflation. And it assumes the local communities are continuing to provide their funding at about 29% of the overall cost of operating. So you can see it looks like a pretty good picture, but I want to eventually show you how the capital situation makes this not quite as rosy as it looks. First, just to look at a couple of the funding sources. The motor vehicle sales tax has been a great value to Greater Minnesota Transit. It gives us a funding source that kind of moves with inflation, whereas most of them seem to stay flat. And obviously operating costs move with inflation, so it's important to have something that's moving with the operating costs. And you can see that the forecasts for motor vehicle sales tax over the years have bounced up and down, but by the time you get to the actual year that it is available to the Greater Minnesota Transit, the forecasts have been pretty close to what was actually provided. However, on the lease motor vehicle sales tax, those forecasts have bounced around like crazy. And I show you this mostly to say that while the future looks pretty good for us, we're always concerned that this lease motor vehicle sales tax won't turn out quite as well as we hope. And we want to make sure that we don't over-program ourselves, given that what could happen with that. I mentioned a little bit about the vehicle funding, and this chart is intended to show how we've traditionally gotten funding for buses in the past. I do have an error in this chart. The two bars on the right for 2019 and 2020 should be at essentially the same height as the 2017 and 2018 bars. I apologize for that. The point of this chart is to show how up until that tipping point in 2017, where the MAP 21 funding decisions really take hold, we're kind of okay, but then we tip down. And that, combined with the other picture for the operations, is going to have to work together. The state money that we get, the general fund and motor vehicle sales tax, can be used for capital as well. And under this scenario, more of that money than ever before is going to have to be put towards the capital side, the bus side, in order to keep the bus fleet of Greater Minnesota Transit in a state of good repair. I do want to mention, too, one other fact, I guess, that for our forecasts. So when you do combine this picture of the operating costs and the capital costs that we anticipate for the future, we will reach a peak in about 2015 or 2016 of meeting the need for transit in Greater Minnesota, given the expected outcome of the funding sources. That'll be at about 73% of the need. And after that, inflation starts to beat the funding sources, and it slowly tips back down again for the future.
And
Mr. Shadower, what about how much comes to Minnesota from federal funds for these capital purposes? How much are we looking at losing?
Well, it has varied in the past, but right now we'll be looking at the combined surface transportation program plus formula sources from the Federal Transit Administration, providing somewhere between $10 million in the beginning years, $14 million at the top, and then it drops down back to $10 million again.
And $14 million. Okay, thank you.
For the foreseeable future. So some of the activities that we're doing right now kind of tie back to what I was talking about at the beginning, where we have a program or initiative that we call Transit for Our Future, where we've been encouraging the three C's that we call coordination, cooperation, and consolidation. That's really been a good way for us to get our transit providers to work with the transit providers that are adjacent to them and blur the boundaries that sometimes have prevented better service in the past. So where a person might not have been able to get from point A to point B because they were in two different transit areas, some of these programs can help make that possible, either by making it one transit service area or by cooperation programs between the two. It also ties in closely to what Tim Henkel will be talking about next, that kind of coordination effort, because it's not just tied to transit agencies working with transit agencies. We're also trying to make sure that they work with other agencies' government-provided transportation systems, whether that's Veterans Administration, Human Services, school buses, what have you. We're looking for ways to do that. And then finally, I'd just like to mention that every year we produce an annual transit report. It's due out by February 15th, and it contains information for basically the year that ended about a year before that, where we have all the detailed data by then. So you'll be seeing that come out soon. That's it for now.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Shadower. Questions, members? Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we don't need to get elaborate on the answer here, but if I were to go back to Olmsted County and ask anybody about why Olmsted County is not involved in non-municipal transit, who would I ask, and maybe what would they tell me? But in particular, who would I ask? Who's responsible, or is no one responsible?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's a variety of responsibility points. One place to ask is our office. Another place to ask could be the Olmsted Council of Governments. And actually, there are a number of municipal service providers in your area, with Stuartville also having service. So one of the ways that we're always trying to explore is if there's opportunities for them to grow some way that expands it to the county in general. But there has to be a local interest also in providing the local share that it will take to provide that service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There must be more to the story someplace. I can't imagine that we don't have rural service. Virtually every other county in our area does, and there must be a story.
We'll add it to your where does it happen.
Good way to put it.
Right. Who do I ask where does it happen, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair?
All right.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Shadow.
What I'd like to say is that if there is a interest that either you can generate or the county can generate, if you bring that to our office, we will do a lot of legwork to bring those interested parties together and figure out if there's a way to tie together a local will and funding source with the sources that we can provide through this federal and state government.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Members. All right. Let's move on. Mr. Henkel to the Council on Transportation Access.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. In addition to the work that the Office of Transit does, the state Minnesota State Legislature required the formation of the Minnesota Council on Transportation Access. That requirement was put in place back in 2010. This committee that was formed succeeds the Interagency Committee on Transit Coordination, which was established earlier by Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty. I'd like to spend just a few minutes briefing you on the legislation and the requirements, and just briefly talk about some of the accomplishments and initiatives that are underway under the purview of this council. The state legislature did create this particular council. The council, as stated in legislation, is established to study, evaluate, oversee, and make recommendations to improve the coordination, availability, accessibility, efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and safety of transportation services provided to the transit public. The membership, as specified by statute as well, is summarized here. You can see that there are a total of 13 members with a great diversity of representation of state agencies here in the state.
Seems like I should.
The legislation requires that the council report annually. And January 12th of this calendar year, the council did forward a report to you. That report is available online and also in hard copy format if you need a copy. I'd like to quickly go through that report and summarize the 2012 activities and accomplishments summarized within that document, talk about the work priorities for the appropriation that we work with, and some of the council recommendations for further improvements for transportation coordination.
Members, that report was forwarded to you by Mr. Gordon, one of many that we sent in that email to you.
In addition to three well-received mobility management webinars that were put on earlier in the spring of 2012, the council has accomplished three activities, initiatives, or products. Those are listed here on this slide. First of all, the council has investigated the economic costs and benefits of various transportation coordination strategies in Minnesota. This work is intended to help the council understand and define better what coordination is, to establish a baseline for moving forward with best practices when it comes to coordination activities in this state, and to put in place a barometer, so to speak, for those types of initiatives that can be examples for moving forward with additional coordination in this state. Your report gives you other examples. You can see on this slide one of the examples, SmartLink. That is summarized in the report. The work of the council has also obligated funding in the amount of $75,000. It's matching funds for the development of one-click transportation website as part of the Veterans Transportation and Community Living Initiative grant. This puts in place an improvement to that system, make information available to over 68,000 veterans, military personnel, and, of course, others in this state, to provide access to transportation services and transit across the state of Minnesota. Finally, the council has developed and proposed solutions for the management of non-emergency medical transportation services to the Department of Human Services. Those solutions ensure the coordination with local public transit programs, resulting in decreased service costs as well as increased abilities to leverage some of the federal funds that are available. In the spring of 2012, the council also conducted a strategic organizational analysis facilitated by Minnesota Management and Budget, which resulted in a work plan for priority activities for 2012 through 2014. This gives you a really quick snapshot of the high-level priorities that the council will continue to work on, including the identification and elimination of barriers for vehicle sharing in the state of Minnesota, as well as to identify and promote the usage of service delivery models for implementation in Minnesota, which will include additional study and look at brokerages, examples focused on competitive market forces, as well as mobility management focused on individual customer needs. Based on work that was done in the spring strategic work planning activity, as well as work that has been accomplished, studies that have been completed, there are a series of recommendations which provide the foundation for continued work action that will move forward in fiscal years 2013 and 2014. Those are listed on the next two slides. They include recommendations for state agencies to conduct demonstration projects, for the legislature to support recommendations made by the Minnesota Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Committee, specifically to use bus passes for NEMT clients to increase the use of public transportation when it's accountable and cost-effective. Also, for vehicles used in human service transportation to be made available to other state, federal, and publicly funded programs. And finally, recommendations for state agencies to work together to create funding mechanisms that support their shared ownership of funding responsibilities, as well as the need for state agencies to support the implementation of those strategies that are identified in another work activity where the regions in local human service transit coordination plans. And finally, state agencies that deal with transportation services should agree upon common measurements and definitions for tracking and reporting the cost of services. Through its ongoing efforts as a state-level coordinating council, the Dakota continue to advance the goals on transportation coordination in Minnesota. Not only has it created numerous tools and resources for local use and served as a valuable single source coordination resource for the transportation community, its existence has also fostered connections that promote a heightened level of transportation cooperation and communication within state and local government, in particular those partners that are members and sit at the table monthly to have conversations. Most importantly, the Council's economic cost case studies illustrate the actual cost reductions and other benefits attributable to specific coordination efforts throughout the state. The Council's recommendations for non-emergency medical transportation have the potential to generate significant savings and cost, create consistent levels of service for recipients of the Minnesota health care programs. Work program that we put in place creates more specific guidance for high-impact projects that can be adopted in Minnesota local communities. Actions that will occur through continuing initiatives of this council may put forward legislative actions at some future date that help us to eliminate some of the silos, whether it be funding, regulatory, legal, that come from some of the work that we'll do on vehicle sharing analysis as well as some of the service model activities. So that is my quick presentation on Makota. I would stand for any questions that you might have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Henkel. I wanted to recognize Noel Schugert back, who helps lead the work of the Council on Transportation Access, and commend you, Mr. Schugert, and you, Mr. Henkel. This is a tremendous report. My quick question is to your final point, legislative. I mean, some of these sound really, really hard to do. Or at least we'll need to provide tremendous legislative guidance and bring parties together. Vehicle sharing, for example, is a difficult and sticky issue. But it's been done very successfully in other places. Members, this is an instance where a particular social service agency has a stream of funding. They buy a fleet. They provide that service to their clients. They're accountable to those dollars they spend. And then those vehicles sit for 23 out of 24 hours and do no one else any good. So how do we, you know, but can't criticize them for making them unavailable. Those are their cars and they have responsibilities, they pay insurance, et cetera. So just, you know, letting other folks use them just doesn't work for them because of real actual issues and barriers. So how do we sort through that? It's been done in other places. How do we combine, you know, ease of dispatch so one person can call just one place and they get the right kind of transportation according to whatever the nature of that particular trip is. Sometimes it's going to the doctor. Well, that's possibly a Medicaid service. Or they want to go shopping. Well, that's not a Medicaid service. And they get confused. They're seniors. We want to keep them in their community. You know, they can't sort through who to call for their ride for a particular purpose at a certain time of the day. So how do we combine some of that transportation service dispatch, all that, how do we allocate those resources. So my question, Mr. Henkel, is you anticipate bringing forward legislative proposals involving the legislature and sorting through some of these problems, asking for resources?
Mr. Chairman, members, there are significant challenges associated with those areas that will be reviewed. Some of those challenges I believe to be legal in nature, and if those particular legal issues do show themselves, we will need to bring those forward as potential actions that will help us to address and deal with those. So the potential is high for that to occur.
Okay. Well, members, anyone who has an interest in this work, I think it's really, really interesting. There are great examples that come to us from other places. I think, actually, going back to the ICTC and now this entity, they you know, I would encourage you to read their reports and their past reports. They're at the cutting edge of all of this. It's as good as anything you'll find from around the country. We just and a lot of successes to show for it, what Mr. Schadauer talked about, but a long ways to go still. So I'd encourage you to really dig in. It's a really interesting arena to work in. See if you can't pick up some policy initiatives working with Mr. Henkel and Mr. Shugart and Mr. Schadauer, and we'll work on it. We'll get something done this year in this committee. Any questions, members?
Mr. Chair, just a quick clarification. It seems like the statute expires June of 2014. I want to just understand the ramifications if we have to reauthorize the program.
Yes, Senator Franson, we would have to reauthorize and provide a little bit of money to keep them going if we think their work is important.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further, members? Okay, so we meet next on Monday, and we're going to hear from the Department of Public Safety. And maybe we'll have a confirmation hearing. We're not sure about that, and we're going to hear their budget. So we'll receive the Department of Public Safety overview as well as their budget overview, and we may have Commissioner Zelli in front of us for confirmation. All right. Anything else? See you next Monday. We are adjourned.